Yes, yes, everybody. Producer Griff here. Craig's away doing some of that telly stuff, so I am at the helm this week. He's mad busy, I'm mad busy, so we are rehashing some old content in the vain attempt to satiate your podcast thirsts. Last weekend saw Line of Duty hit the screens once more. We are honoured to have had many of the alumni and current stars on our podcast, so we're going to treat you to some excerpts from those interviews. And plus, it gives me the chance to air my clumsily crowbarred theme tune mashup into our podcast. Very underappreciated, that, I thought, when we first put it down. What you're about to hear are clips from, in a very particular order, Mr. Tony Pitts, Neil Morrissey, Vicky McClure, Adrian Dunbar, Maya Sandy, Danny Mays, and Martin Compston. All of these episodes are available in full on our ever-expanding back catalogue, and I'm going to link them in the show notes below. So if you do fancy having a listen to them all, click through there, and hopefully it'll take you to, I don't know where it's going to take you actually, probably iTunes. Let's get to the clips, and I will speak to you again briefly at the end.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Made it in, like, I think I've repeated this pattern through my life. I made it, I made my own reality within it. Again, that sounds, but I did make my own. So we came to an agreement at the end. They said if I,
you in the school?
Yes, me in the school. If I wasn't disruptive and didn't lead others into inappropriate behaviour, I could bring a radio and sit in the cupboard in Val, the secretary's office. That was the accommodation.
Were you disruptive?
Yeah, but not in. Oh, it's all right. Somebody's,
it's okay.
It's okay. We've got I think we've got to recognise that somebody came to the room that I didn't just have a complete.
Someone was just creeping down the stairs
Are. Yeah. No, I was disruptive, but I don't think in a. I mean, I remember. Yeah, I mean, I probably was disruptive. I was disruptive, but I think I'd like to think in a there was some art in it. Do you know what I mean? I like to think that there was some art in it. I wasn't nasty. I remember having I was disruptive, but I think it was more. I organised bingo.
At school?
So I used to, in the lessons, from lesson to lesson, I'd give kids bingo cards and then call the numbers during the lessons. And you could do line or house, and then eventually Stephen Elliott shouted house really loud and it all came crashing down. And that was more that, it's not that I wanted to play bingo, I had no interest in bingo, but I do remember liking the idea of there being another culture within that. So where they thought they were teaching us about Pythagoras' theorem, somebody was actually waiting for 27 for a line. I like that.
Right. That's fantastic.
Right.
Did you have a good set of friends at school?
They turned on me. They sniffed me out. I played myself. I played a version of myself. I played that sort of.
We all do that.
We do that, yeah. Then I think as the years went by, it became apparent to them, as they started turning up in see-through plastic shoes and enjoying Shakespeare and Laurie Lee. And, I think there was a bit of a sniffing out went on. And there's but that's the beginning of what... Like it seems essentially life is, which is finding your people, right?
Yeah.
Finding your people.
It's an interesting thing you say that because I was listening to you, bloody hell, this podcast sponsored by Rich Dawley. Rich Dawley comes up again with you and Richard on the Radio 4 thing.
Yeah.
And I think it was you that said, you know, we and I'm not quoting, but something like, you know, we spend our life looking for our people and who are our people. Yeah. And once we find our people, that's it.
I
completely agree with that. My wife always says, yeah, but Craig, you know, they're not your people or they're not my people. That's right. I think it's a beautiful phrase. I don't hear it said by many people. So when you said it on the podcast, it really pinged out because I immediately knew what you meant.
And that beautiful thing of so I'm 55 in a couple of weeks, that beautiful thing of, because you kind of think, I found them. They're in, you know, you make that mistake in your 20s and your 30s, you think they're your people, but they're not your people. They're just visitors. But that's all right, they're just there for that part of the ride.
Yeah.
But the beautiful thing is I've found, in the last 10 years, I've found two or three people that are, you know, out of a clear blue sky that, and the sense of, it's just that thing of, I think it's your starting point with people. So you're talking rather than explaining. Do you know what I mean? So we're not explaining or having to feel the weight of each other. You just...
And in a way, it can be effortless.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And I know when I found those people because I feel very relaxed in myself. I don't feel nervous.
That's right.
And you can I don't feel judged.
Yes.
Especially if I worry that somebody is better educated than me.
Right.
What if they're judging me?
Right.
And if I'm talking to someone and I don't feel it, I feel, oh, great.
Well, right, right, yeah, sure.
You know, it's your constant...
Sure.
I have that worry within myself. But if I feel relaxed...
Well, it's... Yeah, I mean, painfully simple thing, but be as you wish to seem. I remember reading that as a 12-year-old and the full weight of that... keeps on landing. Be as you wish to seem, and to be able to be you, and because only you know what a terrible person you are, right? You know all the terrible thoughts you've had, all the terrible deeds you've. Only we know that. So it seems to me that it's about accepting yourself. You know, it's about accepting who you are, and that's. And I think that depends where you start, you know. I think your starting point dictates a lot about your later years. What you see is down for people, what you think's down for you, for your life. See, I didn't grow up in an environment where there were actors and writers. I didn't see actors or writers or musicians or artists. I didn't see them.
If you've got to remember, it was I was born in 62, so any time between 62 and 72 when I was taken into care was we're Irish family, Irish parents, you know.
And where was your Irish heritage from?
My mum's from the north, Armagh,
yeah.
South Armagh, and my dad's from the south, Kilkenny. But it didn't matter. If you were in England and you had an Irish accent in the 70s, then you were bombing the English, you know.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So there was a lot of racism against the Irish at that time, which is still sort of hung over from the 50s and the 60s when the massive... well, even before that, when there was a massive influx of Irish people coming over here, you know, because of various troubles, etc. So we had that, so we were tarred by that brush a little bit as the family. Not that we understood that as young children, but that certainly, retrospectively, must have had a sway on the social services when it came time for them to decide that it was unsafe for us to live at home any longer.
Why? Do you mind me talking about that?
No, go on ahead, yeah.
Why did they deem it unsafe for you to stay at home? Was it you and your two brothers?
Me and three. There was three brothers.
Three brothers.
Yeah, we were very naughty children, that's for sure, but we were feral. I mean, whilst my parents were nice people, they were terrible parents. They were proper go down the pub and leave them indoors parents when we were very young, you know.
What, if like I was about five or six, that young girl.
Yeah, even, who knows, could even be before. I remember being about six and sitting at the top of the stairs and screaming my head off until a neighbour came round because my parents were out, you know. But how much does that disturb you? I don't know. How much does it, how much of a scar does it leave? I don't know, really, you know. I've always been a fairly sort of calm person in general. But yeah, those kind of, that's kind of what was going on. I'm not sure, however, the council moved us because they didn't pay the rent as well, so we ended up in a kind of a horrible house where they had to go and burn the coal fires. There was no central heating, no bath.
Yeah.
They had to go and burn the coal fires to dry the walls out before we moved into it because their rent wasn't getting paid on the previous house or something like that. I don't know. It's a scant memory. There was no indoor toilet and there was no bath. And this is, we're talking about 1970s here, you know, it's not the dark ages.
Yeah.
And you used to wake up and the plaster had fallen off the roof onto your bed, you know, and things like that. It was a squalor. But then the social services who placed us there said that the house was unfit for us to live in and therefore unsafe. And so they took the children away. But they were the ones who put us there in the first place.
And what's the age differences between you and your brothers?
About 2 years between all of us. So there would have been Danny is the youngest. He was... when I went into care, he would have been about 8, going on 9. Then there was me, who was 10. Steve, who was about 11, going on 12. And then there was John, 12, going on 13, who was the eldest. Steve's no longer with us, the one, my elder brother. There was 2 dark-haired and 2 fair-haired. The fair-haired ones were the youngest and the eldest, and then in the middle, me and Steve, we were dark-haired, dark-eyed. But Steve had a massive accident in his 20s, and... ended up having all kinds of brain damage and was then a real problem person, you know, never really got over this kind of mental issues that he had. Ended up doing a couple of stretches in prison and was found dead in a flat in Wolverhampton 3 weeks after he died. Probably, we think, experimenting with heroin.
Right, and were you? Did you lose contact, or were you still close at that time?
During his period when he was absolutely mental, we all, the family, sort of lost contact with him. And I don't want to sound awful, but he was such trouble. He'd go and burgle your house or, you know, hit your children or attack you. And he'd always be attacking other people. And it wasn't his fault. He really was in a weird state. And he wouldn't take his own medication. He was constantly in contact with out-of-body people, God. And, you know, he's sure he could talk to God. And he was always having conversations. He was one of those people walking down the street having conversations with voices, etc. So he was in a proper state, and he wouldn't take his medication. And
did you, as a unit, as a family, try and reach out to help him? Because obviously,
yeah, everyone did. My parents were both psychiatric nurses,
really?
So yeah. So there was plenty of, but there was no. You had to, if you even in that state yourself, particularly at that period, you had to go and seek help yourself. It couldn't be forced upon you. Even when he was in prison, because he went and served a couple of stretches in prison. No one really, it was just the mental bloke in cell 14 or whatever it was, yeah. Whatever he was. And so when he was out, it was just dangerous to be around, and he was constantly causing trouble. I mean, in terms of really, we'd break into my mum and dad's house and foul the whole place up, and I mean that in the absolute toiletry sense.
Right.
So there was a kind of a fear of him as well, because he was very strong and, you know, so in a sense, when someone is, it was such a burden on the family, and it was awful. It was one of those situations that when he did die, it was like a sense of relief, and not just for us, but for him, because he was able to rest. His mind must have been so active with the voices and the demons and the devils and the behaviour, which somewhere inside his head he must have known was inappropriate, wrong, and self-torturing, etc., that it was a relief for him, and it was a relief for everybody when we were able to bury him, you know.
When I was, so from, say, like the age of 19, that's when I started working in the office, and I had an office job, and they paid me a wage.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't any different to a normal office wage, it was just a wage. So therefore, I could afford to look after myself. And pay for my phone bill and pay for my train fares and pay for, you know, whatever it was I needed, because I wasn't from a wealthy family where they could pay for things, for this and that, for everything, yeah. You know what I mean? So I got a job, and that's what kept me in good stead, because then I could just work, and then if an audition came up, I'd take it unpaid or I'd take it as holiday or whatever, and then I'd go to London, do my audition, 9 times out of 10 didn't get the job. Come back, crack on. I'm still working. I'm still earning a living. Yeah. It might not work out. This acting thing just might not work out, but I still need to have a job.
Because there is that constant doubt in your mind.
Yeah, of course. And then odd jobs had come in, and then This Is England, the film, happened when I was 21. Shaved all my hair off, went to the office. Hiya! Sorry about this, just be temporary. And then... So after that, again, thought, this is it. This is going to be fine. It's all going to go great. Done a film with Shane. It's an amazing film. I'm fiercely proud of it. Didn't do anything. Again, just the odd things here and there. Obviously, then I did that bloody film with Madonna.
I think it's so inspiring, certainly for younger people, whether they're training now and they're listening to this, or they want to go to drama school, or maybe they look at you on TV and think, oh, it's plain sailing for her, but it isn't, is it?
It's still not.
No.
I don't believe it ever will be, because, you know, even if somebody said to me, right, I'm just going to pass you Julie Walters' career and say that's yours forever, Jesus Christ, like, the pressure of knowing that you've got amazing work to come up, but you've still got to nail it. You've still got to do the work. Yeah. You've still got to turn up and turn up and perform. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't matter what job it is, whether it is a short film where there's no budget, whether it is a big BBC drama, whether it's a film, whether it's theatre, whatever it is, you've got to turn up.
Yeah.
That's as simple as that. And that isn't easy, because, you know, I wake up in a crabby mood. Think, I can't be fucking bothered, you know, or I don't really like this scene, or, you know, we're all human beings. It doesn't matter what job you do.
Of course.
You know, but the one thing you can't do in this industry is pull a sickie.
No.
You just, you know, unless you're dead.
Your leg's got to be falling off.
Your leg's literally got to be falling off. And so you've got to sustain it. And whilst you've got that job, because you don't know when the next one's coming, if you haven't got anything lined up afterwards, you've got to, you know, go in there and be like, right.
I think one of the many things when I was training that was absolutely smacked into me was be punctual.
Oh, God.
Because once that, if you're not there, I would get there 10 minutes before. If you're not there, I remember running late once for drama school, got there, like a minute past, or even seconds past the hour, doors locked. I can see people.
Yeah.
No, wave of the hand, you're out of there.
It was exactly the
same. You're gone for the day.
Ian Smith at the workshop was exactly the same. And
you're the one that's losing out.
You know better than anyone, I am so punctual.
Oh, my God.
If you say you're meeting me at 9 o'clock, I'm there at 1:45, and annoyed you're not there at 5:02.
I hate to say the word anal, but yeah, probably. Yeah, I know.
And that's been drilled into me just because my family are renowned for being on time anyway.
Were you pissed off when I was 2 minutes late for this podcast?
I'm not even going to talk about it.
Oh, my God.
No, I'm joking. But it's definitely done me a good, you know, it's put me in good stead for this industry, because, you know, the hours are insane.
Yeah.
You do have to make sure, you know, you're on time and you
have to
be professional.
Fit.
You have to be professional.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Keep fit. Do, you know, I'm always in the gym.
Always in the gym. Never seen a burger through your mouth.
When am I going to go to the gym? When is this day going to appear?
I've seen that. It's been happening for about 7 or 8 years, as far as I know. I think you've got lovely gym gear, but actually...
I've got really nice Adidas trainers that just sat there.
They've never seen a treadmill in their life.
Never seen a treadmill.
I know you're quite active on social media.
Sure.
And in this day and age...
Because
you probably are an inspiration for young kids. Do you ever get letters through the post or requests through social media asking for funds to train, to help them, or...?
I can't say I've ever had anyone asking me for money.
Right.
I've had loads of people ask me for advice or interviews for their dissertations and things like that. And I have done, you know...
What you can.
What I can.
Yeah.
You know, it is impossible. Social media is... I love social media for a lot of reasons. In other ways, it can be a dangerous place to be because, you know, you're accessible... For lots of different things. And, you know, I think it's dangerous to open the floodgates because, you know, I've got stuff to do. It's like I wish I could, but I can't give myself to everybody. But I certainly do what I can. And, you know, people will just ask for like pearls of wisdom for the industry. And I always go back saying the same thing, which is just stick to who you are.
Yeah.
Because you are the most interesting thing to them. And I remember going to auditions back in the day, and I'd try and change my accent slightly, you know, make it less knots, and just try and be really overly lovely and polite. Not that I'm not, but, you know.
No, I can vouch for that.
Just try and be something I'm not and talk about things that I didn't really find interesting, which I was just trying, you know, it's a bit like, can you ride a horse? Yes. You know.
Good at trampolining?
Yeah.
You betcha.
Yeah. Like, just basically be a yes man. I think it's important to go into any meeting or in any situation to be honest and say, oh, no, I'm not really into his films, but, you know, I can appreciate why people like them. Like, you know, I'm not really into Star Wars and stuff like that. I'm not really into Harry Potter. So people go, what? You don't want to?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, I'm not. And that's all right. Like, I can't be involved in everything. We can't all be everything to everybody.
Well, the world would be a boring place.
Well, it would. Yeah. And I just think people, you know, if you go into an audition and you try and be one thing and you get the job and then you get on set and you end up being yourself and they go, hold on, you're not what I met in the room. And then you're fucked.
You know, so there's been a huge amount of variety in you know, what I've done. And then, like, you know, out of the blue, as you know, recently, this series happened called Line of Duty, which is now about, I think, 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah. I was thinking the other day, God, how long have we known each other? And it is going back to that time.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy, yeah. It is crazy.
Because it started out as such a small little thing for us.
Yeah.
You know, that we all invested in and all knew how incredible it was. But that small bunch of us that were there from day one.
I was looking through I was searching for some work that I've lost. I don't know I don't know how I did it. So I was looking through all my downloads and all my stuff the other day. And I came across this cast list of that particular period. And there were the names of, you know, everybody. Like, you know, Martin's character and Vicky's character and so forth. And then just said Superintendent Ted. You know, so he didn't actually have a name at that point. You know, he didn't know his name was going to be Hastings or anything like that. So it was like, in those early days, as you say, none of us knew really where it was going to go. Or what was going to happen with it. But, you know, we could tell it was good. And, you know, and there's a great bunch of people, like, yourself and Neil and Vicky and Martin and Lenny James. You know, how brilliant was Lenny? Yeah. And, you know, and Nigel. I mean, Nigel Morton, Neil's character, you know, great characters and all the rest of it. So, and that was kind of coming full circle when you think of me and Neil going to that party.
I know.
On that Saturday night. To get into drama school, and here we were together, you know, many, 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 many years later.
Many adventures later.
And doing Line of Duty. And, of course, we didn't know. I mean, it was only, as you know very well, probably about halfway through the second series that it really caught fire. And even episode one of the second series didn't get good numbers. And then suddenly, halfway through, the numbers started going up. And it was touch and go whether we were going to get a second series in the first place. So thank God the BBC decided to, you know, to go with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was great that BBC Northern Ireland got behind it, Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's been kind of one of those, for me, it's been an absolute, you know, game changer, godsend. You know, the sort of thing that you really... You would keep your fingers crossed that you would get, you know, because I'm 60 this year. So it's like kind of, you know, to get it at this stage of your career is such a gift, you know, a part like this.
I bet, because you've had such an interesting career doing loads of different things. And I was thinking about all the years that I've known you, and I remember thinking, oh, Adie's finishing the acting now, and I remember saying to him, what are you doing? Oh, well, I'm off to go and do the Brendan Behan thing, or I'm doing the Beckett Festival. You're always keeping yourself creative. You're always doing something.
Yeah, I think it's important for actors. Like you know, you're doing this podcast now. I think it's very important for actors to stay in their creative head at all times. You know, you've got to keep, you know, being, no matter what you're doing, you know, you know, I know actors who are really good at carpentry, for example, and will go and or they're good at painting, but you know, they'll do something that they can put their creativity into. You can't let your creativity lie around. You can't wait for the phone to ring thinking that somebody's going to... You've got to get either right, you've got to get up and perform, you've got to do... Somehow, if you can, I mean, I know that it's difficult, but if you can, you've got to explore other things that you can do. And, you know, it might be putting on a poetry reading somewhere, you know, because those things are wonderful, you know. People love those events. And at the moment, I've put together this incredible show. I think it's incredible, where I've taken T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, and I've broken it into four voices. And a friend of mine, Nick Roth, has written this new music. And I found the BFI recently put online the first ever colour footage of London in the 1920s. And it's absolutely extraordinary. Petticoat Lane, you know, the barges on the Thames, all that kind of thing. Very, very evocative. And just at the right time for the poem, when the poem was written. And I put all three things together, and it's really an extraordinary evening, you know. And art, after all, after a while you realise that art is simply being able to make the connection between things. That's all it is, making the connection between colour and emotion, making the connection between, you know, words and emotion, and the visual connections that they, if you can find three things that connect with one another, it's not necessarily that you have to be original all the time. What's important that you can see how things slot into one another and complement one another and create a new whole, if you like. Three things that you thought were whole in themselves, you put the three of them together and suddenly, bang, something else happens, you know.
I never really liked being with people the same age as me at school. And at school, you know, you're always with people the same age. As soon as you do drama, it's like...
Well, you wanted to be with people that
I wanted to be with people older. I did.
And I was like that.
Yeah. Because I like to be tested, and I like to learn and watch people. And, you know, you can learn, obviously, and especially now you can learn from younger people all the time. But I think at that age, you want someone to look up to, you want people to follow, because you don't know who you are and you don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
So you kind of go, oh, what are they doing? That's interesting. I remember getting obsessed with this girl in one of the shows that I did on the side, where she was like 17, and she seemed so old to me, but I must have been about 13, 12, 13. And she could do a no-handed cartwheel. Get your head around that.
Do you know what? Even now at 41, if I see someone do that, that's fucking impressive.
It's amazing. And I remember her, she was called Vicky. She could do a no-handed cartwheel, and I was just like, she's amazing. And then I had all these lovely role models who rolled, and all from different backgrounds and, you know, different classes, different talents, you know, dancers, singers, actors, drummers, all sorts of things. So I think, and then I got frustrated at senior school because it was so academic, and I just didn't like, I could go with the academia fine because I did like to work. I like to work hard, but I just felt like there's something else now.
Did you not have drama as a GCSE?
No.
Or
there was no drama
extracurricular
GCSE. There was, you could do drama, like you could opt for it in one of the things, but it was so rubbish and it was just so half-hearted, and you couldn't really like get your teeth into it. So then I could get my teeth into when we did the show, which was West Side Story. I could really get my teeth into that, and they really went to town on it, you know, and they kind of made it such a big show and they did loads of performances. And then I just thought, I've got to try for drama school, because you know what, everyone kept saying to me at 18, straight from school, they won't have you.
Yeah.
You should go to university. You should go to Cambridge. You should go to Cambridge and get a degree. And I'm like, okay, right. Yeah. Well, I'll apply for Cambridge, but I'll also apply for drama school and see what happens. And you know, they'll decide, because if they think I'm ready at 18, I'll go because they'll take me. And if they don't, fair enough. And then I'll do something else. But I'm going to let them decide because I want to go. And then, you know, so then I went to Lambda. And
what was the support like from your parents?
My parents were incredible. My parents are really liberal anyway. And they're passionate about... they've always been passionate about like nurturing whatever you feel you are, whatever you want, like,
and supporting that.
Yeah, even to like, and sexuality wise, you know, I'm straight, but when I was like about 13, 14, I remember I hadn't shown any interest in any boys at school or anything like that. I hadn't brought anyone home and whatever. And they sat me down at the kitchen table and they were like, just so you know, whatever you choose to be in life, whoever you fall in love with, it's absolutely fine. We accept everyone into this house. I'm like, do you think I'm gay just because I haven't brought any boys home? Oh my God, have you seen the boys in the boys' school? They're disgusting. Like, and then my first boyfriend ended up being, he was an amazing West Indian cellist and he was gay. So that was the first person that I brought home. So, yeah.
So they fully supported
you. They totally did.
You,
yeah,
in every aspect.
Yeah, they weren't nervous. Obviously, as a parent, you're nervous about, you don't want your child to be rejected. I think that's the biggest thing. You don't want your child to just be rejected and depressed and, you know, you don't want them to struggle financially. You don't want them to have a hard life. But then you also don't want to tread on their dreams kind of
thing. No,
so,
of course.
You know, so they were like, they found it hard, I know, at times when, because it's, since I found writing, I'm totally happy. But I did suffer from depression at times when I was just waiting for acting work and I had to do lots of side jobs and I was getting really frustrated just waiting. And I think they saw that and they felt really powerless. And, yeah, you know, I think as a parent, you just, because now I feel it, now I've got a baby and I, even when he's got a cold and I can't make it better, I feel like really crappy. But I think that was their concern. It's like, we don't want you to be sad, basically, you know, we just want you to enjoy everything you're doing. And so like now they're just completely content because I've got so many things on. But they would never ever ever have said to me, you can't do that.
The first ever, I was thinking about this, the first ever performance I ever did, I can't believe I'm going to share this with you now. They did a production of 40 Towers.
At what age?
I was at infant school, man. It was like young.
Really?
Yeah. And I remember remember some form of audition or something like that. And my mate, Glenn Watts, got Basil Fawlty, and I didn't. That's the role I wanted. And I was devastated. I can remember crying and all that sort of stuff. So I didn't get the gig. And then Glenn Watts was rather naughty, and he lost the part, and they gave it to me. But I can remember on the school stage at St John's, Danny Williams was Manuel, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it's mad how your memory goes all the way back. That was actually the first ever, you know, I can remember being on stage, I can remember people laughing, I can remember the response to it. So, yeah, there you go. The first thing I went up for, I didn't get it. And there's a pattern here. Welcome to the world of acting, Danny. It ain't going to change.
Well, did you get the buzz then, do you think? Would that where it start? It must have started prior to you. Well, you must have had a little something in.
I tell you what it is, I think, and someone, a journalist interviewed me, and, you know, being one of four boys,
yeah,
you know, it was a rather loud, boisterous but loving household, sports mad. It was either golf, football, or cricket.
Did that come from your dad?
Yeah, my dad used to play for Kelvin and Hatch. He was a fantastic footballer, as were my two older brothers. I mean, they're quite dominating presence, really, in the household. Particularly my older brother, Paul, was probably the best footballer out of all of us, you know. And I just followed in their footsteps. I mean, way back when, I mean, I was like most kids, I just wanted to be a footballer.
Yeah.
I was captain of Loughton Boys. I played sweeper at the back, you know, shouting away and ordering people around. So that's really what I wanted to do. I was sort of really into sport and things like that. But then gradually, I think being, you know, the third in line and being that middle child, you sort of shout to be heard a bit, and maybe the acting thing kicked in or performing kicked in to try to be different.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean? Because I was always jumping around doing impressions. I was either doing Frank Bruno or Prince Charles or, you know, pulling my ears out and all that sort of stuff to me mum and dad's friends. So I was always, there was always a sort of need to be loved. No, just to be recognised.
Yeah.
But whether
or to
that
be
was
heard.
But this journalist said, well, maybe that's, you know, subconsciously that was happening because you were, you know, one of, you know, a middle child. And so,
and also in a male-dominated house.
Yeah, very, you know, it was very, yeah, that male-dominated. It was very, you know, there was always something happening. And my mum and dad in particular, were very, they're very gregarious people. Do you know what I mean? They were very, they're very social people.
Mm.
We would always go away on a holiday. They've got a huge network of friends. So, no, they're really popular, but they are. You know what I mean? We would go away to Cornwall and all these places and... you know, one of my best friends, Matthew Farr, he's one of four boys. So it was like, in Buckersteel, there was the Mays boys, four. There was my mum's best friend, Rita Farr. She had four boys. And there was another family, the Gibsons. So you had the Gibsons, the Mayses and the Farrs. So you can imagine the stuff we all got up to. I won't say anything more about that.
Do you still have a close relationship with your brothers now?
I do. I mean, I've been really lucky, both with my brothers and my mum and dad. They have never wavered in their support in the sort of career path that I've chose. I've been so blessed in that respect. You know, it's sort of a bit left field, isn't it? You suddenly turn around. Because it all really started with dancing, really.
When did the dancing come in?
Well, as you know, Craig, I can do a mean Michael Jackson impression.
I know this, but I've got to, I've got to build it out there to the listeners. We've got to build it up.
Kick on Billie Jean now. that's really where the whole thing started.
Did that come? So that come after Fawlty Towers? Was this still at infant
school? Oh, yeah,
that
Fawlty Towers was way back when. And then I was playing football and just being a normal boy. And then one, I'll tell you what exactly what it was. It was, I was probably about 11, I was about 11 or 12.
Mm.
I opened up my stocking at Christmas. My mum put in a cassette of Michael Jackson Bad along with a Michael Jackson video. The legend continues. See, it's just ingrained on my brain. I can remember it like it was yesterday.
Because we both auditioned. You were in first and then I went in, didn't I?
Yeah, you were fucked then, weren't you?
What?
You were fucked then, weren't you?
Fucked then. Oh, well, obviously. I was just not short enough. Yeah. but then I found out, I remember we both got the call the next day,
yeah.
Didn't we?
Yeah.
And I went, I don't even know what this part is. Yeah. So I had to go back and look. And I went, oh no, this is really interesting.
And then you were swaying a bit, going, maybe no. And I said, you need it.
Yeah, no.
Because then Jed was like, it was the big twist was coming.
But I didn't know about that. And there'll be spoilers here. Yeah. But I didn't know. But I thought, well, you're doing it. Yeah. The script's amazing. Vicky was doing it. Yeah. Lenny was doing it. And that's all I knew at that point. I didn't even know AD or Neil was doing it.
Morrissey was in.
Or the Morrissey. It is episode 100. Myself and Mike Combs from Manchester having a little glass of wine. Cheers.
Cheers, Slancher, brother.
Slancher. So where are we? Auditions. How are you in auditions? Because there's been many times when I've met you and we've run things before as pals, do you know what I mean? Not been up against each other. That's the only time we've been up against each other. But how do you feel going in? Because it comes up time and time again on this, and I do like to talk about it.
It's miserable, man. Like, the thing, what's become a lot more prevalent now is obviously the self-tapes, which I'd probably... Because we've done a fair few of those as well.
Yeah.
But the thing is with auditions, man, is I don't think at times they're a conducive environment to get the best out of people. Some of them are very cold, like, Jesus. To be fair, Britain's probably a bit easier. America is fucking horrible.
It's very cold, man. Yeah.
It's come in, stand on that dot, go up, speak, line, out.
Out.
It's miserable. Actually, I don't think I'm going to tell you this, actually. One of the worst...
Great.
One of the worst auditions I ever had was for Star Trek, Scotty. So I'd literally just landed in LA, and I told... I'll tell you about this later as well. I had these super agents at the time, and I was like, look, I just want to get in the first day. I just want to settle. Give me a day to get my head together. I'm not crying. And I literally got off the plane and they went, so I got in at night and says, Martin, we've got an audition for Scotty tomorrow for Star Trek. And I went, guys, man, I was like, it's tomorrow, like, my head's going to be buzzing. I'm like, look, it's Scotty, you need to go for it. And I went, right. He says, it's one scene, don't worry about it. I went, all right. He says, we'll get it to you tomorrow, because you've got to sign this thing to get it.
The NDA.
He says, so the audition was at, like, fucking, I think it was like 12. So I got up, no sleep, obviously, jet lagged. Get up in the morning, got to go try and get that early so I could learn the thing. And it's a 3-page monologue about fucking space mechanics. And I'm like, oh my God. And I need to be off book. I can't look, because if I look down, I'll break it. And then when I start thinking about where I've got to go, I stop acting. So I need time to prepare it. So I learn it. I go through it. I think, right, I'm on this. So I go to the... start going to the audition. And it was on, I think it was on Olympic somewhere. But nobody told me that all streets in LA run east and west. So my audition was at the beach in Santa Monica. And I went fucking east to Koreatown. And I pulled up at this place and it was like a Korean massage parlour. And I was like, and then I went, is this like a test? So I fucking went up and like chapped the door and I was like, this week, I'm like, hello? And I went, is this Star Trek? And she's like, no, like with some Korean accent going, no, massage. And I went, no, Star Trek. And she went, no. And I was like, oh, fuck, man. And I went out and I phoned my agent. I'm like, I don't know if this fucking thing's right. And I went, where are you? And I went, no, it's in Santa Monica. And Santa Monica's the beach. It's fucking the other, it's miles away. So then I'm late already. And he says, look, we've got you in for 3.
What time is it now?
So now it's like 1.
Right.
So that's, but it's an hour and a half back the way in fucking LA traffic. So I get there, it's fucking roasting, I'm sweating in the car. Get there just for 3. And then get in, walk in. So I'm like, just in time, like, thank fuck. Boy goes in. And then another guy comes in behind me and goes in. And I'm like, all right. And then another guy comes in and she comes out, shouts his name, goes in. Need to tell me you had to sign in.
Oh, God.
We don't do that here.
No.
And so you've got to sign in your name to let you know you're here. So I'm sitting there till 5:30.
What?
Like, I fell asleep.
You fell asleep.
And then she comes out and locks the door and I'm like, aye. And I'm like, I'm here for Star Trek. And she went, are you Martin? I went, aye. She's like, well, why didn't you sign in? Like, then she's getting a bit irate at me. Like we've moved around your hang and all that. I'm thinking, like, nobody fucking told me. So I walk in. She's like, right, take a breath. And she opens, and she's opening up, putting the camera and that back on for me. So already it's like...
Already it's a no-go. My God.
And then, so I did the first page, and then I come up to this bit, and I went, oh, fuck, what's the next bit? And I just blanked. And I went, I'm really sorry. And she's like, yeah, it's fine, look. But if you blank again, don't, just look down. The thing's in front of you. And then I got out something in my head going, like, I can't even look down. So I go, again, this bit's coming. And I'm going, what the fuck is this line? I know it's something to do with quantum mechanics. Oh, fuck, look. And then I couldn't find it on the page. And then I went, oh, no. And she went, I say it again, Martin, just look at it. And then I went again, obviously fucking blanked again. And then I just started laughing and I just read. Like, I literally just read it. And it was the worst fucking feeling, like, walking out there the first day of pilot season, destroyed. Just wanting the ground to swallow me up. Just walked out and he said, hey Martin, did you fucking, how was it? And I'm like, terrible. Like, worst fucking. It's like, I want to go home. And then, weirdly enough, I said, look, I need to get back in that room. And they said, and then the big casting director, this lovely, she's a massive April Wessler, who's J.J. Abrams' casting director. She said, I come back in 2 days later. And she was there. And she just said, ah, you were in your own head, don't worry about it. And that was fucking lovely. Smashed it. Got a call back, met J.J. Abrams and all that kind of thing. It was I can't remember, what was Tommy's second name, but his first AD and co-producing partner was a Scottish lad. And apparently he'd put in a word for me. Obviously, then went to Simon Pegg.
I sincerely hope you all enjoyed listening to that. Nice to go back down memory lane and perhaps uncover some gems that you haven't familiarised yourself with before. Yeah, that's it for this week. I should do that exit thing that Craig does really, shouldn't I? I've been Producer Griff, he's been Craig Parkinson, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast.